The Origin of Man. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 28. And God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish, or literally fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. If this brief passage, embedded within the six-day creation account of Genesis 1, is all that we had concerning the origin of man, it would be completely sufficient in itself to dispel from our minds any idea that man had any physical relationship to the animal kingdom by some type of evolutionary process. For in this brief but very clear passage, we are told that man was created by God to be the king of the earth, to exercise dominion over all animals. But even more important, we are told that God made man in his own image and likeness. What do these terms really mean? As we trace their usage throughout the Old Testament, and as we observe today, the contrast between man on the one hand and the animal on the other, we gain a clear picture of at least some of the implications of these words. First of all, man and man alone in this world has complete self-consciousness. That is to say, man is aware of himself as a person. No animal for one moment could ever say within his own heart or mind, I am an animal. If he did, he would cease to be one at that moment. Of course, above and beyond this world, there is the living God who has perfect self-consciousness, and therefore speaks of himself in the book of Exodus to Moses in these terms, I am that I am. Because of sin, man has lost his own complete self-consciousness and therefore must confess to God whatever secret or hidden faults he may have. God alone knows himself completely, but man has self-consciousness as a reflection of God, as a part of his image and likeness. Also, man alone of all living things on this earth has real purpose, goals that he can set for himself in this life, in the light of which he can adjust his daily activities and his schedule. But no animal has such self-imposed purposes or goals. No squirrel, for example, could ever say to himself, I don't think I'll gather nuts this fall, I'll wait a year. He doesn't have that power, because he is completely bound and straitjacketed by a complex instinct pattern, which more or less dictates to him his whole routine and pattern of life. He does not have the freedom that God has within himself perfectly and that he has given to man as a reflection of his own image and likeness. Furthermore, only man of living things on this earth has a rational mind capable of abstract thought that can be expressed toward other men in genuine true speech and thus to produce genuine fellowship of minds and hearts. Some zealous evolutionists have spent months in cages in the Amazon trying to detect with tape recorders incipient speech patterns among monkeys, all to no avail. Others have thought they could find speech patterns in porpoises with various squeaks that have been analyzed carefully over the years, but with equally futile results. The fact of the matter is, as one has put it, the real reason why animals don't talk to each other is because they have nothing to say. They do not have rational minds. Furthermore, only man can really be educated and taught. Animals can be trained to do various things in response to certain signals, but animals cannot actually be taught or educated. Animals never learn anything that they can pass on to the next generation. Each generation in the animal kingdom begins where the previous one began. There's no real progress through the centuries in attaining new skills, in learning how to actually handle or to invent tools. Therefore, there is no real history in the animal kingdom, but simply an endless reproduction series from one generation to another. Furthermore, only man among living things on this earth has complex emotions with a capacity for sadness or joy that produces weeping or laughter or even a frown and a smile. No animal is really capable of these expressions of real emotional capacity. Furthermore, only man has what we call the aesthetic dimension, with a capacity to appreciate art and music creatively. Furthermore, and even more important, man alone has a moral nature, has a God-given conscience that is a monitor, detecting for him the slight deviations from his instructed conscience in his moral acts. No animal, therefore, is capable of sinning, or can be held guilty, or can be legitimately punished for sin or crime, because no animal has a moral nature. And yet, even more important than all these, man alone of all living things has the capacity to know his God. No animal for one moment ever said, "Thank you, Lord," in the center of his being, because he's not a person. He doesn't have the image and likeness of God. He is totally incapable of offering a sacrifice to God, of hearing God's voice, of obeying Him, of serving Him, of loving Him. And all of this adds up to one thing. Only man is a person, and only man on this earth will continue beyond the grave forever and ever in personal existence. All of these things point to the fantastic chasm that separates the lowest man from the highest beast. Evolutionists can debate endlessly about the apparent similarities of men with the bodily structures of certain animals. But as Dr. Paul Zimmerman has pointed out in his remarkable symposium entitled Darwin, Evolution and Creation, the physical differences between man and the ape are vast in themselves. Only man, among all mammals, walks in an upright, erect posture. Man has a fantastic difference between the ratio or proportion of his brain and body size, to which no ape or ape-like creature or other mammal can be compared. And many other differences in the physical realm can be listed. In fact, so much so that the most avid evolutionists today admit that man did not evolve from any of the types of apes or monkeys that are seen in the world today. In fact, he can hardly imagine what kind of common ancestor man and the ape and monkey came from. All of which is a testimony to the fact that the difference between man and the animal, even on a physical level, is very great. But it is nothing compared to the vastness of the biocultural, mental, spiritual chasm that separates man from the animal. The image and likeness of God in man marks him off as completely unique and distinct in his God-created dignity as King of the Earth. Important though this revelation is in Genesis chapter 1 concerning the dignity of man, God has not left us to that statement alone. but has given us an entire additional chapter in Genesis to tell us exactly how He created man in order that we might understand His original uniqueness as a God-created being, unconnected, unrelated to the animal kingdom. Genesis chapter 2 is not a contradiction to Genesis chapter 1, as liberal critics have often claimed through the years. What it is a retrospect into the events of the first chapter of Genesis, telling us the order of events that occurred in the creation of man, namely, Adam first and Eve later, which we would never have guessed from chapter 1. It also tells us something of the original home that God created for our first parents, the geographical surroundings, the rivers, the mineral deposits, the meaningful work that God gave to Adam even before the fall, and more important than that, the moral test that God gave to him to bring him out of the realm of unconfirmed, immature righteousness to the realm where God dwells, namely fully mature righteousness, knowing good and evil, knowing good in the sense of experiencing it as over against alternate moral choices, and knowing evil in the sense of recognizing it for what it is and continually rejecting it. A maturity that, of course, Adam, in the nature of the case, could not have had at the moment of his creation. And then, the account of the creation of the first woman. It's to this passage now that we would like to turn our attention as we consider the vastly important question. What method did God employ to bring the human race into existence? Could Adam and Eve have been evolved from the animal kingdom by God's providence through long periods of time? This chapter makes perfectly clear that that could not possibly have been the case. Notice the details given, first of all, of Adam's psychological preparation for Eve's creation, then his physical preparation, and then the remarkable things that God did and said concerning Adam and Eve. Genesis chapter 2, beginning in verse 18. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper appropriate for him." You see, in Genesis chapter 1, the chapter ends with everything very good because Eve has already been created by the end of Genesis 1. But now, in typical Hebrew historiography, we revert back, looking in more details of the order of events and the significance of those events. Eve is not yet here. Therefore, God can say of Adam, not good, in the sense that he is incomplete without his God-created appropriate helper. But you see, Adam didn't know that his condition was not good. He was not psychologically alert to the necessity for Eve's creation. And therefore, we may say that God subjected him to an intensive course in systematic zoology that would force him to come to a knowledge of at least three important things. First, the complexity of the task that confronted him as king of the earth. And second, his own uniqueness as over against the animal kingdom. And thirdly, the missing factor in the world, which he greatly, in fact, desperately needed. Let's analyze each of these important things that Adam learned in the first day of his conscious existence. Verse 19 of Genesis 2. And out of the ground the Lord God formed, or had formed, every beast of the field and every fowl of the air, and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. You see, he made no mistakes. His analysis was accurate. In fact, Adam gave names to all the cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper appropriate for him. Consider, first of all, the enormity and the complexity of the world over which God created Adam to exercise dominion. God wanted Adam to understand the scope of his task as king of the earth. And therefore, somehow he brought to him beasts of the field, fowl of the air, and the cattle, speaking perhaps of the more useful animals for Adam's immediate physical needs. And as God brought these creatures before him, we are told that Adam named them and called them by these names. What does this mean? It certainly doesn't mean that he gave arbitrary, meaningless names to the creatures that God brought before him. A totally useless exercise, we may be sure. The Bible doesn't use those terms in that sense. As you trace through the Bible, you discover a very great importance placed upon the calling of names, which is not really true of our culture or society. You ask a man, "What is your name?" And he would say, "John." Well, who would then say, "Well, what does John mean?" He might answer, "Well, what do you mean? What does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's just my name." But you see, in Bible times, names did convey a meaning. They were mental handles by which the identity and characteristics and attributes of persons or things could be recalled. And when a person's character changed, his name was changed. Abram became Abraham. Jacob became Israel. And especially in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, we read concerning the coming Messiah, the King of Israel, "His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." Well, actually, Jesus was never called by any of those names when he was here on earth. No one ever said, "There's Wonderful," or "Here comes Counselor." In fact, Isaiah wasn't saying that they would. He is simply saying this is the kind of person that he will be when he comes. These are his personal characteristics. Therefore, as we look at this statement in Genesis 2, verses 19 and 20, we must assume that that is the basic idea conveyed to us here. Adam was able to grasp the basic characteristics of these animals as God brought them before him. He could see their differences. He could see how they fit in their own niche, taxonomically, in classification, in comparisons. And what he saw, he remembered. You say, "Well, that's impossible. How could he name in this way, grasp the basic characteristics of thousands of birds and land animals? Surely this must have taken months. Maybe this proves that the days of creation are not literal." But that's not the answer. The answer is, you see, that Adam had an unfallen mind. He was not subject to the noetic effects of the fall, as all men since his day have been subject. Our mind, as well as our body, is a comparatively crippled organ, only a shadow of the original virility and power of the first man. You see, even today, according to some psychologists, the greatest genius in the world never uses more than 0.1% of his brain capacity in his entire lifetime. There's something about the mind that simply is incapable of absorbing all of the data, information, phenomena that are poured into it. We become weary, forgetful, mentally lazy. It requires repetition, review, constant work as we concentrate on things that are set before us, as every student in every university in the world realizes completely. But you see, Adam had full use of his mind, fresh as it was from the Creator's hand. He was capable of grasping the details of his environment vividly and recalling what he had seen in what we might call an instant recall, so that he could carefully, accurately, and almost instantly compare and analyze and classify. And the Bible does tell us that whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. To be sure, this did not include the insects. It did not include marine creatures. It did not include microorganisms. It did not include plants and flowers and grasses. But the task was a great one, because even today there are 8,600 distinct kinds of birds, and there were more then than there are now, plus the land animals that were included in this taxonomic exercise in Adam's first day on earth. You see, this passage gets a message through to us that the first man, so far from being an ignorant, savage, recently evolved from an animal, beginning to crawl, as it were, out of the darkness of the depths of his evolutionary past. No, that is a figment of the imagination of the 20th century mind and all of its intellectual pride. So far from that, the Bible tells us that the first man was a magnificent mental and physical specimen. Every inch a king, a genuine true reflection of the glories of his God. And since then, men have fallen into increasing physical and mental weakness through the inheritance of accumulated mutations, so that actually, although today we vaunt ourselves as intellectual giants, we are nothing but pygmies standing on the shoulders of our predecessors through what may be called accumulated knowledge. No, Adam was not an ignorant savage, but a perfectly brilliant man. He grasped the complexity of his world. He was equipped to be its king. Another thing that Adam experienced on that remarkable first day of his conscious existence was his own uniqueness as over against the animal kingdom. We are told in verse 20 that for Adam there was not found a helper appropriate for him. As the animals were brought before him, he smiled, he spoke, there was no answering response, there was no expression of recognition on the faces, in the eyes of those animals. After a short time, we may be sure that Adam, with his brilliant mind, could reach a very clear, solid conclusion. Namely, that he was the only person in the world. There was an unbridgeable chasm between himself and the animal kingdom. If he began his existence thinking he was an animal, or assuming that he had somehow come from them by some evolutionary process, he was disabused of that thought before very many hours had passed. In fact, we may say that before Adam was one day old, he became a solid creationist. He was anti-evolutionary. And yet modern man, in his supposed brilliance, has not even yet learned that basic lesson that God taught Adam in the first day of his existence. God has indeed made foolish the wisdom of this world. There's yet another thing, I believe, that Adam noticed on that day. Not just the complexity of the animal kingdom in all the varieties and kinds. Not only his uniqueness as a person, as over against the animals. But I think he noticed also something missing in the world. Each animal that came before him had an appropriate mate. Male, female. Male, female. And before long, Adam began to see a certain pattern in the world of living things. Each animal had an appropriate mate. But he had none. He looked at himself, male. Where is the female? Where is my counterpart? There is no one answerable to me, no appropriate companion who is a real person created like I have been, in God's image and likeness, to whom I can speak, to whom I can unfold my heart and my deepest thoughts of love and concern. There's no fellowship in all this world for a person. You see, he was now psychologically ready for the creation of Eve. And now, God prepares him physically for her supernatural creation.